The next case is the Federal Election Commission v. David Rivera. Thomas Hunker is here for the appellant Rivera, and Shana Ward is here for the Federal Election Commission. And Mr. Hunker, you may begin your argument when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, Tom Hunker on behalf of Mr. Rivera. With me at council table is co-counsel Jeff Feldman. The primary relief we're seeking in this appeal is reversal and remand for entry of judgment for Mr. Rivera. And the two main reasons that we believe Mr. Rivera is entitled to that relief is that the trial court lacked subject matter jurisdiction due to the failure of FEC to satisfy certain mandatory pre-suit conditions. And the second reason is that FEC's legal theory, the primary liability theory that they ultimately proceeded on, or their, at least their attorneys proceeded on in the amended complaint, does not state a cause of action or is legally not a violation of the statute that they charged Mr. Rivera with. The other two issues are...
Can we start with the second issue that you'd like to have? So first of all, we sent you a notice of counsel in advance. Do you agree, based on our case law, that we don't review a denial of a 12B6 motion at this stage?
Right, and that really wasn't what our intent was.
So let's look at the what I think I understand you say is, even taking all the evidence in the light most favorable to the FEC here, this would not state a cause of action under the theory in which they brought.
Right.
Okay. So let's explore that for a second. Here's what I understand the best evidence on their side to be, and correct me if I'm wrong. Money was given from candidate to a mailing house to pay for another candidate's mail to go out. And that person was told, in giving that money, report it under a different name or under a different means. In this case, report it as a loan from yourself rather than coming from me, right? Does the evidence
not support? Yes, I believe I follow what you're saying. There was a gap in between.
Does the evidence support what I just articulated?
The evidence does not support that.
Tell me why.
It's in issue three. We get to this conflicting evidence there.
Okay, I think I may agree with you on the conflict.
Right.
That's not what I'm asking. Right.
I just want to make sure.
The light most favorable to them.
Right.
Does the evidence not support what I just articulated?
Right. If we get to an evidentiary question on this, I don't believe issue two is an evidentiary question. It's a legal question. But if there is an evidentiary question, the relief we would be seeking is reversal and remand for trial.
Counsel, listen to my question and please answer it.
Sure.
In the light most favorable to the FEC, is the evidence not as I articulated it to you?
That is the evidence that they put forth.
I understand that you dispute
that.
We'll get there in a second.
Sure.
Okay. If that's the case, does that not state a claim for making a contribution in a false name contribution?
It doesn't.
Tell me why.
It goes to the heart of their misinterpretation of this statute, 30122. This is a statute that speaks solely to making contributions. And it's a distinct concept from reporting to the FEC.
I agree with you. Okay. And I understand that the false report in and of itself is not a basis for 30122. I agree with that. But what I understand that they're saying that the evidence supports in light most favorable to them is that a contribution is made from one candidate to another candidate here by paying for candidate two's mail.
Right.
And candidate two is then told, it's not for me, you're to report that, and that is a loan from you. Whether he actually reported that on his thing or not, is that not making a contribution in a false name? In other words, not making it in candidate's one own name, but instead making it as a loan to candidate from candidate two to himself.
I think the distinction is that you are not making a contribution to FEC. You are making a contribution to the campaign. So the case law, except for this case, this is the only case that has applied the statute the way FEC asked the trial court to apply it.
You said the money isn't going to the FEC? It's
correct. The way they're applying the statute sort of implies that a contribution is not complete until it's reported to the FEC. And that's simply not how these statutes operate.
But under the facts as I've articulated, forget the SEC, forget the actual reporting.
Right.
A contribution was made from candidate one to candidate two by means of paying the mail house.
Mm-hmm.
And candidate two is told, it's not for me, You're to say it's a loan from yourself in whatever mechanism, on an SEC report, to the Miami Herald, to anyone who asks. It didn't come from me, candidate one. It came instead from you to yourself.
Right.
Isn't that making a false name contribution?
It's not. And all, if you, it, the way this becomes clear, or at least for me, the way it became clear, is when I started reading all of the cases that have applied 30122. And they're almost all criminal cases because they had to employ these joint liability statutes.
I understand this may be a novel theory under the statute, but that's not really the question for us. The question for us is, does the evidence in the light most favorable to them state a legal theory that is actionable under 30122?
I don't think so, because if the campaign is in on what they're as they're alleging, that is not making a contribution in the name of another.
Where's the money coming from? The money is coming from David Garcia, right? Just follow with me for a second.
That's what they alleged, yes.
The money is coming from David Garcia, and it's ending in the campaign coffers of Justin Leonard Stenard, right?
Correct.
In the name of Anna Saul Allegro, right?
No. In this case, what happened was he put it as unknown, and then subsequently the Miami Herald published a story, and
so when
according
it,
to their allegations.
So when the money went to Stenard, who was it reported that it came from?
Originally, I don't think it was reported at all. When it got in his campaign account,
right. Where was it reported that it came from?
Ultimately, they had to amend their reports to.
Okay, you're not answering my question.
Trying to understand the question, I apologize.
Okay. When the money got in Justin Stenard's campaign account, where was it reported that it came from?
Well, I think that's the key here. If this was not a money contribution to the campaign, it was an in-kind paying for an expense for the campaign, and that's defined within the definition.
Campaign, whose expense?
The campaign's expense. So he didn't have money coming in.
Stenard's expense.
Correct.
This was for the mailers?
Correct, mailers. So he's paying a vendor, allegedly.
That's not the only theory, though, they operated on. That is certainly the bulk of where the money contribution. But there's also money, I think it's a little over $1,000, that went from candidate one to middle person, and then middle person to candidate two to pay for instance, a rental car for a period of time. Is that not also making a contribution in the name of somebody else? In other words, candidate one through a middle person is paying candidate two, but it's coming from middle person to put middle person's name as the contributor, which is what Judge Wilson was asking you about.
Right. I see. The way these statutes seem to work, and reflecting on all the case law that has applied them, and this may be a novel issue, I granted that might be the case, but the way it works is that the contribution is completed when it goes to the campaign. And that's there's a separate statute that deals with reporting to the FEC. They may have been able to allege
and charge. Let me ask this question. At no point was it ever reported that any money for Stenard's campaign came from David Garcia in this record.
Subsequently, he did amend his reports and say it came from David Garcia or David Rivera.
Rivera.
Anna Allegro. So there was a report that was amended to put that in.
But
it was originally reported as a loan to himself. Right. Because the Herald started asking questions about how these things were getting paid for. And that's what really led to, according to the allegations, the amendment of the reporting to FEC.
Okay.
And
so,
I guess this goes to issue two, but is Allegro's testimony the only evidence of David Rivera's involvement with the filings?
That was, relying on the grand jury testimony and the plea colloquy, but for those two things, I don't think they would have any, it would be summary judgment for David Rivera on this record.
Because the Mr. Rivera did not give the money directly to Stenard.
I'm speaking solely based on their allegations. I'm not saying I agree with their conclusions.
I know, I understand. I'm just saying, I'm asking.
Make that clear, but yes.
This is what the facts are.
Correct.
Well, on this record. I'm not, right, you're not in front of a jury.
So that's the third issue. The testimony from Ms. Allegro and, well, I see my time is about to run out.
Can we ask about the first issue? Okay. Can you just talk a little bit about the notice, pre-suit notice and the subject matter jurisdiction?
Yes. So the FEC, Congress created this civil right of action that they can bring, but they first have to meet certain mandatory prerequisites. And it's all centered around communicating with counsel for the respondent about, through informal methods of conciliation, communication, and persuasion in an effort to correct or prevent a violation of the election laws.
So let me ask you though, what do you allege is the difference between the allegations in the amended complaint versus what was given in the pre-suit documents?
Well, I think it was very clear even in the record, and I agree with Judge Cook that these are two separate things. FEC tried to convince Judge Cook that there was already in the allegations of the original complaint, they had both primary and secondary liability. But I agree, they are two different things, and this is why. In the first one, in the secondary liability, which was invalidated in the Swallow case, it was placing a factual position and a legal position that Mr. Rivera was a conduit, a go-between from unknown contributors to the Sternad campaign. When that went away, they had to change their entire factual and legal position to be put him in the seat of the source, the contributor, and that he was not a middleman, that the source of the funds, the ownership of the money was him. The reason why that's important is because through the entire pre-suit process, they were operating solely on the secondary liability theory. And the statutes are very clear that, especially in the context of the general counsel brief and some of the information that needs to be communicated to counsel for the respondent, they're required by law to provide their position on the legal and factual issues. And so it's a complete analysis of what their case is.
So the FEC had to start its investigation all over again?
Yes, well, they didn't have to. They could have conciliated on the basis of both of these theories as alternatives. But in what they wrote, they found that they didn't think he was, at least at that point in time, they didn't take the position that he was the source. And in fact, the commission to date has never taken that position. It was just their attorneys when they amended the complaint that took it upon themselves to do that. This was never placed to a vote for the commission.
Why wasn't this issue presented to the district court?
It was presented after the summary judgment on the factual issues. This is a subject matter jurisdiction issue, and the court is well aware it's a threshold issue, can be raised at any time, including on appeal for the first time. So that's, in a nutshell, what that issue is about. And I would just like to add that the fact that they went and took it upon themselves to communicate directly with Mr. Rivera without including his attorney, and at all times they knew and were reassured.
The commission says they tried, but they were, counsel failed to respond. So if counsel fails to respond, what does the commission have to do then?
Their own evidence attached to the affidavit of their attorney, FEC, shows that counsel did respond. There was a lag period of a few years, mm-hmm. and then counsel did respond and left them a voicemail and said, I'm really busy, but yes, I'm still representing Mr. Rivera. So at all times, no one ever told them she wasn't. And the regulation says, unless and until they are told that he's no longer represented, they are not to initiate contact. It's a no-contact regulation. They violated their own law, and it's very clear. Right. So thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Shayna Ward, and I represent the Federal Election Commission in this matter. Also here today from the commission is Jason Hamilton. The district court properly granted the commission's motion for summary judgment, finding that then U.S. Congressman David Rivera violated the Federal Election Campaign Act in 2012 by providing nearly $76,000 of in-kind contributions to the primary campaign of Justin Lamar Sternad.
Can we talk about subject matter jurisdiction first?
Yes, Your Honor.
It's clear we can entertain our subject matter jurisdiction at any time, right?
Yes, Your Honor, you absolutely can.
Okay, but in his closing argument this morning, he indicated that the FEC had to contact his counsel, and they tried to contact his counsel. What's your argument on that?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. And regarding Mr. Rivera's claims that he was represented, as an initial matter, this is not a jurisdictional issue, nor has appellant provided any cases suggesting that this would be a jurisdictional issue. What matters from a jurisdictional standpoint is if there was notice, attempted notice, in order to conciliate the matter at the administrative stage with Mr. Rivera.
Is your position that that is jurisdictional, that the pre-suit notice things are?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the FEC's position is?
As long as there's the notice part of it, yes, Your Honor. And actually, the case that appellant cites in their brief supports the fact that there is notice. And the key here is notice on the facts. And cases throughout all of the types of cases in the EEO context or in the administrative context generally support that as long as there's notice on the facts, that is what matters from a jurisdictional standpoint.
The Supreme Court in its recent case law seems to suggest that again, looking at it anew, I know if we're in the D.C. Circuit, you're bound by case law. If you're in, I think, the Fifth, they're bound by case law, but we're not. So the Supreme Court has told us when you're looking to see whether something is jurisdictional or not, you really need to be careful to do that. And Congress needs to, I think, speak, it says clearly speak that something is jurisdictional in nature. Generally, it's done by the language of the statute, by some heading. There's some textual indication that it is a jurisdictional provision. Can you point out to me where that I'm supposed to get a clear speaking by Congress that the pre-suit notice requirements, which are in a section titled procedure, that those are jurisdictional as opposed to claims processing rules?
I don't think that I can point to that, Your Honor. And I think that's for good reason, because when you're talking about the administrative process and the conciliation process, what the cases speak to is that this is supposed to be an informal process. And the whole point of that is in order to preserve judicial resources down the line, you want to go through the informal process of conciliation in order to get this issue settled before you reach that point. So I think you're right that I'm not at this point able to point to something saying this is in fact a specific jurisdictional issue, nor has appellant done.
Okay. Can I get to where I think the heart of the issue is?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Do you agree? So you were listening when I was having a conversation with your opposing counsel, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree with me that that is ultimately your theory on the false name statement? In other words, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to you, the theory is that a false name was made because contribution was made from candidate one to candidate two, and candidate two was told to report that not in candidate one's name, where the contribution actually came from, but instead was told to instead report that as a loan to himself, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's the gist of what happened here, but I'd like to also point back to what FECA provides. FECA provides that a person who gives the funds to another for the purpose of contributing makes that contribution. That's from the Whitmore case and the Bender case. And I think one important thing that I'd like to also point out here is that someone can violate Section 30122 by making the contribution and also by receiving the contribution. And that's in line with how the criminal cases associated with this ultimately panned out.
I'm less concerned about the legal part of it. I just want to understand that what I articulated is your theory of the case, right? Yeah,
yes, Your Honor. What typically happens when someone is contributing to a campaign, they write the check, they say, you know, this is for your campaign, and that's deposited in the campaign account, and that's reported as a matter of course in the FEC reports that this person X can't donate it to this campaign, and therefore it's reported as such. That's not what happened here. The evidence is extensive and overwhelming at summary judgment that what happened was an elaborate effort to conceal that name, using cash, working with vendors, directing others how to report it. That is the entirety of the Section 301.
What evidence did you have? In other words, the false statement, the false name was made because it was made in the name of this candidate two in his own name as a loan, as opposed to from candidate one, right?
That's correct,
okay.
Gunner.
As I understand, the evidence that you get from that is from the middle person's testimony in front of the grand jury, where she stated that she spoke with candidate one and candidate one told her, hey, listen, while this whole thing with the Herald's going on, have him reported as a loan. And that's what she communicated to candidate two, right?
That's part of the evidence. She communicated that with the candidate, Mr. Sternad, after getting direction from Mr. Rivera, and that's what we proved at summary judgment.
Okay.
In addition,
sorry, go ahead. I interrupted.
Oh, I was just going to say, in addition to that, the candidate himself, in his testimony, his deposition testimony, also explained how he was told that through.
So you're talking about Mr. Sternad, candidate two.
That's correct, okay. Your Honor.
So that's how I understand the evidence is in the light most favorable to you. What do we do with this? And I'm reading from docket entry 147-4. Quote, at no time did I ever instruct any person or entity to pay money or provide anything of value on my behalf to the Sternad election campaign. At no time did I ever deposit money into a campaign account for behalf of the Sternad campaign. At no time did I ever serve as a source of money or provide in-kind contributions to the Sternad campaign. At no time did I ever instruct Mr. Sternad directly or through another person to falsely report the source of in-kind contribution in the candidate's financial disclosures to the FEC. At no time did I request, direct, or instruct Ms. Allegro to tell Mr. Sternad to falsely report the source of payments to his vendors and to falsely contend that the money was a loan to his campaign taken from his own personal funds. Isn't that a dispute of fact?
That's from Mr. Rivera's own declaration, if I'm not mistaken. And at summary judgment, what is required by the non-movement is to go beyond their own self-serving affidavits in order to create
Show me where in our law, in 11th Circuit law, that's the case. That may be the law somewhere else. But as I understand the law in our court, a self-serving affidavit is just as good as any other affidavit to controvert a fact to create a genuine issue of material fact.
It can be, Your Honor, if it does not, if it's enough to dispute what the FEC presented at summary judgment, which was an overwhelming amount of evidence.
But there's a conflict between what David Rivera is saying I didn't instruct, because the only evidence you have is Ms. Allegriano, correct?
No, Your Honor. We also have the
Mr. Sternad never got the money directly from Mr. Rivera, correct?
That's correct. Nor would he have, because it was part of the whole scheme.
I understand that, but this is almost like a classic he said, she said. And normally those go to trial.
Not in this case, Your Honor. And I'd respectfully say that it's not that type of case to go to trial, particularly where in Mr. Rivera's 7-page opposition to the commission's motion for summary judgment, he did not dispute the 6 independent witnesses that the FEC presented
It could be 100 witnesses. If he disputes it and says, I did not do that, and 100 people swear in a stack of Bibles that he did, isn't that a dispute of fact?
No, Your Honor, I would respectfully say that it's not.
Why?
Particularly because you have this overwhelming amount of
where's,
additional
where in
additional
our case law
evidence.
Is there an overwhelming evidence exception to the
summary judgment? You're right, it may not be worded as such, but what the cases do hold is that where the material facts are undisputed and did not support a reasonable inference in favor of the
crime. But this is, again, a situation where it is not for this court or the district court to weigh conflicting testimony. Okay, that's just the general nature of summary judgment. And there can't be a dispute of a material fact. And this seems to me to be a material fact, which is I never told X to do this. And X is saying he told me to do it. That's a dispute of a material fact.
Well, you are correct, Your Honor, that at summary judgment stage, what is not proper is at a credibility determination.
Right, so why shouldn't this go to a jury?
Because of the uncontradicted evidence presented at summary judgment. You're right that we do have this affidavit from Mr. Rivera himself stating that he allegedly did not do all of these things that the overwhelming amount of evidence suggests and in fact proves that he did. However, again, this is not an improper credibility determination because the non-movement has to go beyond that and show specific facts that create this genuine issue. It has to be more than
how can you show something if I say I told my law clerk not to go through that door and then my law clerk says the judge told me to go through that door? That's a conflict, correct?
It is, but you could also perhaps have additional witnesses to testify.
Okay. And do you have additional witnesses that showed that Mr. Rivera instructed Ms. Allegriano to do what she alleges he says he told her to do, other than Ms. Allegriano?
What we have from Ms. Allegro's testimony is that instruction about the reporting.
Do you have another witness that can confirm that Mr. Rivera told Ms. Allegriano to do that?
That, I'm sorry, can you, do we have another witness that says exactly?
You just said, well, if you have another witness that can verify this, do you have another witness that, that can testify or did testify that Mr. Rivera told Ms. Allegriano to do X, other than her?
We do not have, other than her plea colloquy and her grand jury testimony for that particular point.
Well, the additional, she recanted though, didn't she?
She did not, Your Honor. And I think that this is a key point. The two documents that that Mr. Rivera put forth in this appeal were a bar complaint that was dismissed prior to the summary judgment and a purported affidavit that was filed in the pendency of the amended complaint. And what the district court found is that neither of those actually disputed the facts that were of part of her grand jury testimony. And I think that that's key here because what you're talking about is facts that were under penalty.
The court determined that her affidavit did not, was vague and conclusory and did not dispute her grand jury testimony
yes,
or her plea colloquy, but doesn't it dispute Mr. Rivera's deposition or Mr. Rivera's deposition?
No, Your Honor, particularly where you're looking at the statements that are in her grand jury testimony that mm-hmm. serve the basis of the issues at, or the facts at issue here. What, and if you go through that declaration, you'll see that in a way it was done in a specific way to not make any allegations other than vague and conclusory ones post-amended complaint in order to submit as part of this case versus actually going to the issues there. And I'd like to also point out that with respect to the civil penalty that was awarded here, that was not at all mentioned in Mr. Rivera's summary judgment papers. In fact, he was completely silent on the civil penalty. Only post-summary judgment did he attempt to argue that this penalty was in some way constitutionally excessive or somehow did not meet within the statute.
Can I go back to this, the summary judgment? I agree with you, by the way, on the civil penalty issue, but I'm going to go back to this, what I'll call the affidavit. We'll call it the affidavit. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to say an affidavit saying, I deny everything. That's sort of the general affidavit you're talking about. But if he denies a specific fact that is alleged against him, in other words, the specific fact being, I did not tell Ms. Allegra to do this. I did not tell anybody to have this reported as a loan. And that is the critical fact in showing that that was the false name contribution. Because otherwise, it's just money from him to the third-party vendor that Sternan didn't report the right way. It's that critical fact that gets you to false name.
The critical fact that gets you to false name, and I think that this is important because this is not merely a reporting violation.
I agree.
To be sure, Mr. Sternad could have been charged with a reporting violation. That's not incumbent upon Mr. Rivera, and I think that's where the issue that they're attempting to create.
I agree with you.
That said, when someone makes the contribution and says, look, here's the money, but say it's not for me, that is the essential fact of making the
I agree money. With you. You're right.
Yes.
In other words, you have evidence to support that.
Yes, Your Honor.
But he is saying in his affidavit, I never did that. That thing. How is that not just a general denial, but a specific denial? And there is specific evidence that he could present to a jury denying that fact. And let me just put a finer point on it.
Sure.
The district court rejected the affidavit based on Scott versus Harris. That's the citation there. And Scott versus Harris is a video case. And what that line of cases says is where something is incontrovertible as a matter of science. In other words, what is alleged in the affidavit can't be true because there is video, scientific evidence, whatever, then we can disregard it. But we don't seem to have that situation. You might have mounds of evidence on your side, and they might have a molehill on their side. But as long as it contradicts the main facts in the case, why is that not up for a jury to be able to disbelieve that as opposed to a judge?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree that it's not the same facts that are posed in that case. I would also say that it's uncontroverted in the sense that it also goes against what Mr. Rivera testified in his deposition, and that's presented in the district court briefing as well. And I get your general point about is how is that not enough? And I think that you're still faced with that it has to be more than just a bare assertion. And to Your Honor's point, this is not, you know, uncontroverted by scientific evidence and all of that. I do agree with Your Honor in that regard. But as the district court held, Judge Cook and Judge Cannon below did not find any issue with this, given the substantial amount of evidence that the FEC presented. I see that my time has expired.
All right. It has expired. Thank you, Ms. Ward.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from Mr. Huneker. So, Mr. Huneker, tell me exactly what he said in his deposition. I don't have it in front of me. The deposition is in the record, right?
Yes.
With regard to where the money that came out of his pocket was expected to go.
I don't have it in front of me either, Judge, and I don't recall specifically what was said, so I really can't speak to that. I know that it's in the record.
Well, you need that evidence in order to create an issue of fact to get the case to a jury and avoid summary judgment, right?
Well, Mr. Rivera, from my recollection, he definitely did not say that what they're saying the evidence was, what they're saying contributing and buying these things for Mr. Sternad. He did not.
It's clear that about $75,000 came out of his pocket and ultimately ended up to support the candidacy of Sternad. Right?
Well, that's what their position is.
And you say that the evidence doesn't support that?
No, the evidence is in conflict. And that's why summary judgment is not, it's a classic he said, she said. I think this at best.
Where does he say the money was intended to go? In his deposition.
Because he wasn't involved in it. That's what he testified to. So you have Allegro testifying in exchange for a plea,
he admits that money came out of his pocket and went somewhere in his deposition, right?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. No. We'll have to look at his deposition.
Right. I'd like to just touch on briefly back on the subject matter jurisdiction question, because first of all, I think it was brought out that this is an admission in their brief. I know you can't admit and stipulate to jurisdiction, obviously, but they do recognize that their statutes and the rules that apply to this agency.
I get that the FEC's institutional position is that this is a jurisdictional issue.
Right.
We can't do anything about that, but I can tell you, and I'm only speaking for myself, I'm not bound by their wrong reading of the law.
Certainly, certainly.
I get the D.C. Circuit has said what it said. It said what it said over 20 years ago. The Supreme Court in its last 5 years has been very clear about jurisdictional rules. And in my mind, if we're going to look to see whether this is jurisdictional, which is the first question,
right,
you'd have to look at that law and apply
Absolutely.
It correctly.
And I think that, importantly, this statute existed for a long time, and it creates a cause of action, even creates the FEC itself.
I guess my question is on why we don't necessarily have to decide, and I think this is something Judge Wilson asked you about, which is, and Judge Lagoa, doesn't each of the documents that you're talking about, the pre-suit notice one, the GC notice, the conciliatory document, all reference 30122 and the violation of 30122?
Yes, but it has 30122 side by side with the Swallow regulation. It's a Roman numeral 3, and that's how they.
But they're and this and that. It violates both of those things. Why is that not?
No. My reading of that is that they had four options in their regulation of how this statute can be violated, and it's Roman numerals 1, 2, 3, and 4, and what it used to be before they repealed Roman numeral 3.
Right. So, counsel, I'm reading from the pre-suit notice. This is at docket entry 171-5 at page 2. The commission noted that notified Mr. Rivera that it found reason to believe that he violated three provisions of the act, specifically 2 USC sections 441A1A, 441F, and 441G. One of those is 30122 now, by making contributions in the name of another. Okay, that seems to be noticed. Now I'm reading from 172-1 at 31. The commission then reminded Mr. Rivera that it, quote, found reason to believe that you knowingly and willfully violated 2 USC section 441A1AA, 441F, and 441G, now 52 USC sections, including 3122. The Office of General Counsel is prepared to recommend that the commission find probable cause to believe that knowing and willful violations have occurred. More of the same later on that same document. I can keep reading, but each of those documents references something similar. It seems to me that that's enough notice, is it not?
Well, it's a different violation. They look at it, what is the violation? And the violation that they communicated, and if you read the part about
them on notice of the three separate statutes and some regulations that they were considering investigating, found reason to believe he violated, wanted to conciliate, and then bring charges on. I
understood.
I fail to see how that's not the minimum of whatever notice is required by these procedural provisions.
Right, but the manner of violation that they alleged, their factual and legal position, because this is the language of the statute, what has to go in the general counsel's brief that they have to communicate to counsel when represented is the factual and legal position, the position, and that changed completely, so much so that they had to amend their complaint, and then what they really would have had to do is, Roman numeral one under the regulation, they shifted from 3 to 1. And so it was a completely different violation, and it was not ever mentioned. Roman numeral one under the regulation was never, that interpretation of one of the four ways that it was violated was never mentioned in the pre-suit process. So for that reason, we believe there is, it is a subject matter jurisdiction issue. And to conclude, I would ask that the court take a look at the case law that deals with creation of a cause of action and what that means in terms of whether you have access to the court, whether the court has ability to hear the case when you don't do what you need to do to proceed.
All right. I think we have your argument. Thank you, counsel. The court.